Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're taking you on an Italian jaunt today.
Yeah.
Starting with a concept that is very Italian, and I don't think that many people in the U.S. understand it. And so we'll talk to Marissa Huff about aperitivo, which is a grand Italian
tradition. A daily tradition, not only. It's sort of like English afternoon tea in a different sort of way. But Marissa's a great person to explain it since she's lived in Italy for the last 15 years or so, and I'm sure she indulges in an aperitivo practically every day. So here's Marissa, right?
Well, if Joe Bastiani says so, I say this has to be a good book, and it turns out it is. We're going to be talking to Marissa Huff, the author of a book entitled Aperitivo, The Cocktail Culture of Italy, which is a delightful book. Tell us a little bit about your background, because it's so interesting, and then we'll get into how you organize this book. Marissa, you've been in this business for quite some time, actually.
That is true. I originally studied abroad in Italy my junior year of college in the town of Padua, now where I now live, and during that time, I experienced my first aperitivo, which is a very big deal in Padua. It's a university town, and spritz flow like water. You better believe me in the sense that you can purchase a spritz for probably less than the cost of water in some bars. Mm-hmm. And so visitors to the city will find these piazzas just pouring over with people sitting outside drinking neon-colored spritzes, either with Aperol, the orange-colored bitter, or Campari, the bright red-colored bitter. And to the point that I even remember a Vanity Fair article that came out once and named the city the public drinking capital of the world.
Oh, you're kidding. I never knew that.
There's so many people outside enjoying these the aperitivo and spritzes in particular. So from that experience, I fell in love with pretty much all things Italian, and particularly the food and the wine culture. And later went on to work for Slow Food in Bra. I did, helping to organize the first edition of Terra Madre back in 2004.
Wow, that's huge.
It was. It was a big endeavor. And thanks to Slow Food, I made the connection with Alice Waters and then moved back to California, where I'm from, and spent some time working with her before moving then to New York.
Massimo Bottura always says Italy is the home of fast cars and slow food.
That's absolutely the case. I living in a town like Padua, I'm actually able to use my bike more than a fast car most of the time. But still, Italy
he's in Modena, of course.
Yes, he's in Modena. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Which is also flat as a pancake.
Yes, yes.
So anyhow, so you moved back to California, worked for Alice Waters. What better training could you get than that, huh?
Absolutely. Then I moved to New York, where I had the good fortune to be able to meet Joe Bastiani at just about the right time, and helped him to open Del Posto, and was there for 3 months as part of the hospitality staff, and then moved on to work with Jeffrey Steingarten at Vogue magazine for
You mentioned child, so we should mention that Marissa just had a baby in January. So it's a wonder you're not sleeping all the time.
And that has a connection with aperitivos?
No. I think she...
maybe it does. Maybe.
One too many aperitivos, one too many aperitivi, and I ended up with a child.
I was just hinting at that. I wanted to get a quick question in here, because I'm sort of surprised. Now, my wife says I'm surprised because I'm ignorant. Because I don't go out shopping for a cocktail at 6 o'clock every day like she would if I was doing the right thing. But my first thought when I opened the book was, what Italian aperitif hour is there? I can't remember noticing one, but you've told me that obviously there must be. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, well, you know, in traditional Italian way about one would approach the aperitivo by drinking something on the lighter side. So if it were to be a cocktail, it could be something like an Americano, which is made with Campari, sweet Italian vermouth, and soda water. And there are a number of other variations on this drink. You can add gin to replace the soda water, and it becomes a Negroni.
That's one of Peter's
favorite. In my book, I also give... What was that?
Peter's, that's one of his favorite drinks, the Negroni. I don't like them. But we always drank Campari when I was a student there.
Yes, so Campari on the rocks, Campari with soda, Campari with orange juice is popular as well.
Yeah, but I like bitter. It's bitter.
Yeah, those are all bitter. And then if you're interested in something on maybe more the sweet side, there are all of the variations of the Bellini that one perhaps could order.
Oh, right.
Right, so you could have it with a strawberry puree if you prefer, with orange juice, and it becomes a mimosa. So there are lots of other things.
Well, that sort of leads me, when you say about the cities, I mean, there's Bellinis are associated with Venice.
Absolutely.
And vermouth is associated with Turin.
Yes, because that's where it was born, let's say, or came into being.
But I mean,
Campari is associated with Milan because the original Campari bar is right there in front of the Duomo.
You know, I loved reading about that in your book.
Besides, you couldn't possibly drink something in Milan that was originated in Torino, could you?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, it's so funny because the precursor to the Americano that I had just described is a drink called the Mito, M-I-T-O, which is the Milano-Torino. So it's a combination of these two, what were, you know, the big working cities, and they producing each one a major Italian cocktail ingredient, and you combine the two and you have yourself a cocktail.
Now, you haven't mentioned vermouth in here yet.
I just did.
I don't think Marissa has mentioned.
Yes,
well, vermouth, the sweet Italian vermouth, yes, is from Turin.
Okay.
It was created using local wines that were fortified, and then different botanicals were allowed to soak with the alcohol in order to give new aromas to the product, and originally were served as something almost like a panacea, something you would get, you know, at the pharmacy. And when they then started adding some of the sugar, it became a little bit more palatable, and people enjoyed drinking it. And you must know that back then, Turin had a big coffee house culture, the cafe culture. And this was something that someone could sit down and sip besides coffee. So that's a little bit of the history.
Okay, so that's how that came in. And,
well, part of the rationale about this book is, to you, aperitivo is an entire experience. You subtitle it the cocktail culture of Italy, although we need to modify that because it's really more prominent in northern Italy.
That's correct.
With a little in central, but very little in southern, although you did find some in southern.
Some. And I do explain that... what you will, you, it's not that it doesn't exist entirely, but what you might find, let's say, on the shores of Sicily could perhaps even be, you know, people from Milan on vacation who have imported this tradition and get together to have a drink before dinner and possibly even using local ingredients. But it's not something that necessarily was part of the local tradition years ago in places like in southern Italy, let's say.
Now, you organized the book by city.
Yes.
Turin, Milano, Florence. Somebody told me that the food scene in Florence was finally picking up, but Peter says he thinks somebody's making that up. I never understood why Florence had such a rotten food scene, except that there are so many tourists there that they didn't have to bother much, right?
It's kind of like Venice. Venice suffers,
Venice
from,
food's
Venice suffers from the same problem.
But you do have some good recipes from Venice, which moves us into another element here, which is Italians don't drink without eating something. In fact, many civilized countries are like that. You don't just have a drink. You have to, in Greece, nobody would just give you a drink and nothing to eat. And in Italy, they couple these smart aperitifs with finger food, bar food, some of it getting kind of elaborate, but you have all the recipes for what goes with what in here, too.
Absolutely.
And some really good ones.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
Do you have some favorites that you've seen flipping through the book?
We were actually going to ask you what your favorites are.
Oh, really? Okay. Well,
Yes,
of course. You just mentioned Venice. In the Venice chapter, I must say that I am a sucker for the fried sardines with the salsa rugine.
Yes.
So it's a fried, fresh sardine was served with this light, slightly spicy mayonnaise, which I find just completely irresistible. Anything fried during the aperitivo is fantastic, I believe. It's something that gets you, you know, it really wets your palate, eager to eat more and drink more, particularly because it, you know, often
that's
salty as well. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And then in terms of cocktails, I personally have been drinking a lot of Americanos. I used to be a Negroni drinker, but after I had a child, my tolerance has gone down dramatically, so I can't really handle those. Yes. So I also include in the Milan chapter a very fun recipe for what is called a beer Americano.
And you substitute out
the soda water for beer foam. So you get the little aerolatte, the little whisk, mechanical whisk that one normally uses to froth milk for a cappuccino, and you use that with a light beer like a lager, and then you can pour that on top of the Campari and the sweet vermouth to make this drink.
I thought that sounded really interesting. Peter said he thought it was awful sounding.
It didn't sound like a very sensible thing to do with beer.
I guess if
you need something because you don't like the beer very much, then I suppose that's okay.
Well, that's the other thing she says, that there's an emerging craft.
I was going to come to that one.
Yeah. There are actually two
elements somewhere into this cocktail culture, but we haven't mentioned them so far. One is sparkling wine, and the other is beer. So maybe they certainly fit. We just didn't get around to talking about them.
Absolutely. So I didn't really give recipes for those because I don't imagine that someone's going to sit down at home and then try to make their craft beer for an aperitivo. I mean, unless they're a big...
There are a lot of people making craft beer.
There are. But what's happening in Italy, let's say, in terms of the sparkling wine scene, I discuss the difference between what's Prosecco and what is champagne or champagne-style wines. So both of those are drunk in Italy. Prosecco made from the Glera grape using the Charmant method, which means the wine itself is carbonated, whereas champagne is a process that requires a lot. Actually, Champenoise, it requires a lot more time and the involvement of humans to rotate the bottles, or sometimes it can be mechanized, but still.
Yeah, I never knew that until I read that.
Well, the difference is there's no secondary fermentation
in the bottle. Absolutely.
That you do for champagne. You feel like you cheat a little bit on that by just injecting bubbles into it.
Which is perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. And also you see a difference in the price. And also there's difference in the flavor of these wines as well. You know, champagne is sitting on its yeast, and so it develops some more complex flavors, whereas Prosecco is something that's fairly light and easy to drink, which is great for an aperitivo, and also great, you know, for mixing with other things, like white peach puree if you're making a Bellini, or bitters if you're making a spritz. So there are many things you can do with that.
Then
in terms of beer,
right now
there's a big craft beer scene in Italy as well, so it's not just here in the U.S., but over the past 15 years, they went from having maybe, I'd say, a handful of craft breweries, primarily in Piemonte and Piedmont, to now what is over 500. And that's really taken off. So beer is definitely something that you might see someone drinking as an alternative.
I've never had a beer in Italy. Never.
Even a Peroni?
No.
Well, I have. I made up for your share.
Okay.
There you go. Yeah. Well, if you ever get a chance to go by Italy, I know that here in New York, they definitely carry a lot of the Italian craft beers.
Yeah, we've been to Italy. Before they keep opening, we were just talking to Lydia. I'll tell you, they're opening those Italy's everywhere.
They certainly are.
Oh, my God. You have more crostini recipes than you can shake a fist at. But, you know, I had to agree with you. The first time I got a Trautnetzini, with the bread, that awful spongy bread mm-hmm. with the
white
crust,
bread, yep.
Yeah, with the crust cut off. I didn't know what was happening.
I felt the same way. I was shocked as an American to come and find what I figured was the equivalent of Italian Wonder Bread all over the place. But I've actually come to love it and appreciate it and find that even at my local grocery store, I can find a version of this bread that is made with only four basic ingredients. So you're not, it's not, you know, laid down, heavy with chemicals and other things to stabilizers to make it last longer.
No, you're photographs are wonderful, but you do something that I hate in a book, is you do not put captions under them, and it drives me absolutely insane. I'm looking at this picture Venice from the main canal, and to me, the church I'm looking at looks like Santa Maria della Salute, but is it?
What page are you on?
There's no page number either.
look at a page before or after that, and I'll be able to.
You're being chided, Marissa.
179.
Just in case you didn't notice.
Is it Santa
yes,
Maria?
Yes, that does look like, yes, La Salute, yes, absolutely. This caption thing you can take up with the editors at Rizzoli. Okay.
Yeah, but
you can file a formal complaint. And regarding the photographs, I will share your compliments with Andrea Fazzari, who is my photographer.
They're great.
She's fabulous. And one thing that's really special about this book is that all of the photos were shot on site in Italy, so it's extremely authentic in that sense.
Well, I would hope so, yeah. Okay. You should be congratulated. And I imagine you're probably dealing with new motherhood now. You're not working on another book, or are you?
I'm not working on another book at the moment, no. Yeah. We will see what's to come, but right now I am focusing on my daughter, you're right.
Yeah, and I think that the people who pick up this book should know that there is a selection, a selected guide. You just pick your city, and it tells you where you can go to be pretty secure that you will find good aperitivos and part of this culture.
Yes, absolutely. I felt that it's important that this is not just a book that will allow you to recreate the aperitivo experience at home, but should you make it over to Italy, you can use it as a travel guide and visit some of the places that I visited myself and found inspiration.
It makes me homesick, to be perfectly honest, Marissa. I think we ought to get on a plane. Instead of going to Chicago, I'd rather go to Italy.
There you go.
So anyhow, thank you for talking to us, and I wish you success with this book and with your darling child.
Thank you very much.
Sounds like fun, doesn't it?
Yes.
Maybe we should have an aperitivo today in honor of Marissa. And we're probably going to have one fairly soon anyway, right?
Yes.
When we head to one of our very, very favorite overseas destinations later this year, we'll undoubtedly indulge. And we'll be still in Italy right after the break, but we must take one now, so don't go away, and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I'd say that Katie Parla has burst on the scene, and I mean literally. All of a sudden, everything that you read about having to do with eating in Rome or tasting Rome, which is the name of her book, or writing about Italian food and wine, is bylined by Katie Parla. She has a lot to say. She's been there for, what did she say, 15 years?
Something like that.
Yeah. And she sounds like she's having a good time.
She does, doesn't she? And so this is a story about places to eat. It's a story about an eating culture, an eating and drinking culture in one of the world's great cities. And I'm sure you'll find it a really interesting conversation.
Katie Parla, I know Parla is your married name, but I just love people's names that relate to their lives, and it mainly means speaks, like Katie Speaks is what your name is in Italian, right?
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it is my given birth name. I have proof.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Shouldn't it be decal or something like that?
No, it's a verb.
It's a verb. Anyhow, you and Christina Gill, who did all the photography on this, you've lived in Rome for so long now, I can't actually say expats, because you're not really that. You're insiders now.
Yeah, an expat's something else.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think that both of us, between, you know, my journalism work and Christina's photography, we're really deeply entrenched in the food and beverage scene, and you know, our lives are lived in Rome. There's no sort of separate life between Rome and our English-speaking world. We're fluent in the culture and fluent in the language, and it's exactly as we want it.
Well, you know, I said to you, I mean, the subtitle, I guess you call it, is Tasting Rome is the Book. And then Fresh Flavors and Forgotten Recipes from an Ancient City. But you have so much insider information in this, and it's presented so lucidly. I can tell you. Yeah, I mean, you're trained in research and observation as an art historian, so you can tell by reading this book.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many books about Roman cuisine that do a stellar job of communicating recipes, but what I was really interested in doing, and even like desperate to do, was tell the stories of particular venues and traditions, and it's something that you can't just gloss over superficially. It has to be something that's based both in research as well as experience, and I think it's the most logical approach, at least for me.
You know, just recount for our listeners. I know your history, but our listeners don't. How did you and Christina end up in Rome?
I moved to Rome in 2003 after earning my degree in the history of art from Yale. But I had decided much earlier, at the age of 16, in fact, that I would move to Rome when I grew up.
Huh?
And that's a decision I made after a Latin trip when I was a sophomore in high school, and I never changed my mind.
Isn't that
so
interesting?
I moved to the city as a 22-year-old and have been there for 13 years.
Wow. And Christina is a photographer. How did she get there?
Christina works in the Foreign Service, and so was, I believe she was sent or stationed in Rome as part of her diplomatic work.
Mm-hmm.
And she continues to work in the diplomatic sector, negotiating treaties between Australia and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, we used to live in Australia. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, we're having Australian we're having Australian lamb chops for dinner tonight.
Right on is right. Explain a little bit about how you went about this. You had a hangout in an awful lot of off the beaten path places to get this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the book came together very naturally, though, because the places that you know, I've written about are the places that I spend time, whether I'm researching a book or not. They're, you know, the table at Mazzo, this awesome neo-trattoria-type spot in the peripheral Centocelle district. They're the Trionfale Market, which is a bit more central, but certainly off the beaten track, in spite of the fact that it's just three blocks
from the Vatican. Yeah, I don't think I've ever been
there.
Yeah, I don't think
there are all these amazing places for food in Rome that are hiding in plain sight, and the historical center of Rome is, relatively speaking, a pretty tiny place. And going just beyond the walls or even far beyond the walls yields these delicious dividends. And really, like, it's where I find a lot of sort of inspiration and where I find things that you might not expect from Roman food, which, I mean, whether you've been to Rome or not, I think people sort of have preconceived notions of its components or preparation. And I wanted to sort of break down some of those stereotypes.
Yeah, the interesting thing is we were there with our son one year, and this particular year we chose to go to the Campo de Fiori as a market, and it was kind of pretty small.
It's the saddest place in town.
I wanted you to say that.
I mean, there are these wonderful historical photographs that show Campo de Fiori thriving with food vendors selling actual fresh produce and not sort of giving in to the pull that the tourist trade has on so many people these days. So, I mean, every market in Rome, and there are about 125 city-administered markets like Campo dei Fiori, each of those is a mirror of its neighborhood. So in the dead center of Rome, Romans who live downtown have to work. They're busy right. during market hours. They go to supermarkets. And in other neighborhoods, especially in neighborhoods where there's a more mature demographic, you have more robust markets. The market hours and just new cultural rituals, new being, let's say, the 1970s and later, mean that people shop in different ways. They consume food differently. And while I would love to tell you that Romans, you know, pluck fresh vegetables out of market stalls every day and go to the butcher and the baker, that's a fantasy.
Yeah.
Most people can't afford to shop that way, nor is it part of the modern convenience culture that's changed the lives of so many.
Yeah. You know, Paris is the same way, too. But I find that, like, was it Valencia in Spain? There, it's a little bit different.
The market there is so fantastic.
In Valencia,
you can get things in the market that you can't get anywhere else.
Like you mentioned about live eels, you can get live eels in the Valencia market.
I think that's against European Union laws, but nobody's enforcing.
Well, no, I think they kill them when you buy them. That's the difference, I think. It's a matter of timing.
It's a pretty narrow time difference.
So that's why you mentioned all these regulations that send people shopping to Calabria or someplace.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the past decade has seen a lot of changes in the way that food has to be produced, both by Italian law as well as European Union laws. And that has caused, and this is across the country, this is not unique to Rome and its environs, it's caused a lot of smaller food businesses to close because they can't afford to be in line with new regulations. And, I mean, I think this is all happening right now, so in a decade or so, we'll be able to look back with stronger data and sort of trace how the modern European economy has sort of, in a way, destroyed some precious traditions.
Well, you know, we've eaten a lot in Rome, and it's changing in other ways, too. I think the last trip we were there was the first time that we found some really new tending towards more modern cuisine. What was that place, that we went to that was in the middle of nowhere, Rabbit?
It was called Primo Al Pigneto.
You know that place?
Well, you know,
totally. I mean, Primo Al Pigneto is one of the neo-trattorias in Rome. I think there's one architect that does all the, like, post-industrial design and maybe even prints the menus because there's a very specific aesthetic that's associated with the sort of more modern trattorias.
Yeah.
But, yeah, food's changing. To be fair, like, there's definitely there are a number of fantastic people making traditional food and some people even making modern food in a way that makes sense for the culture. So I don't want to be all like doom and gloom. There are silver linings to these changing conditions.
Yeah, well, you know, Massimo Bottura had a terrible time breaking with some traditions in Modena, which was probably even more rigid because there wasn't the influx of all the foreign influences in Modena.
Yeah, and I think at Osteria Francescana, as elsewhere, in the sort of modern food category, they have to rely on foreigners to embrace the food.
Oh, sure. I mean, half the restaurant was Asian when we were there. Well,
there's definitely a predominant number of visitors who are, you know, flying from across the globe to eat in those places.
It's a destination restaurant now. I guess we'll see what happens. The 50 Best is coming up. I wanted to ask you to go over some of your classifications here. Go ahead. You start out with snacks, starters, and street food.
Yeah, the chapters aren't broken down in the classic primo, antipasto, primo, secondo, contorno, and dolce. Instead, it is a thematic layout. So snacks and starters showcases what you might find as an antipasto on a table or as Roman fast food, like sandwiches and fried souffle, not global fast food, but, you know, the indigenous stuff. The classics and variations acknowledge all the greatest hits, cacio e pepe and carbonara, but then there's some evolved plates. There's an entire chapter dedicated to offal, another to vegetables to sort of balance it out. There is a bread and pizza chapter, which I'm super excited about. That was the recipes were written by a wonderful baker called John Reyefalk.
Yeah, but he's not in the city, is he? I was thinking, remember his name and look him up over there, but he's outside.
Oh, he's the sous chef at Metamorphosy, where he bakes the most exquisite bread in town. Metamorphosy is in Parioli.
Oh.
The other chapters are also thematic, so like sweets and then cocktails, which you might not expect from a Roman cookbook, but the cookbook does sort of showcase some of these minority movements in the food and beverage sector.
Well, we just interviewed someone who wrote a book called Aperitivo.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm down.
And it really is a whole different culture that I guess we never really experienced it fully. It's much larger now.
One of the things that surprised us, in fact, was, and it was with the author of Aperitivo as well as your book, that there are now craft beers in Italy rather than industrial beers, and it's something we had never seen before, unless they were non-Italian.
Yeah, totally. Now that's changing.
A
big movement.
So how big is it compared to the U.S.? I mean, in the U.S. there are literally now thousands of craft breweries.
There are about 1,000 craft breweries in Italy, which is a huge increase from like a dozen, you know, a decade ago.
Right.
Maybe 100 a decade ago to 1,000 today. But you know, it's a movement that started from zero and has really boomed. And I think the most recent statistics tell us that 4% of Italians drink craft beer, so it's by no means a huge trend. And Italy is a much smaller market than the U.S., but it is this category where Romans and people from other parts of Italy can be creative because they're brewing beer, they can use indigenous ingredients to assert some idea of terroir, and they are making some exquisite things.
Now, what would characterize them? I mean, if you're looking for a cult trend in the United States in the last 10 years as the craft beer movement has grown, you'd have to say that IPAs, American IPAs, are the ones that stand out. Is there a particular style that stands out in Italy?
Yeah, I mean, I think rather than a specific style, there are ingredients that are sort of thematic. So when I think of beers from Lazio that feel very rooted in the culture, I think of beers that might use grains or even hops grown in the region. In Piedmont, the local beers use a lot of wine grapes or wine must in order to impart a sort of vinous character to the wine and marry the wine and beer traditions.
Uh-huh.
In the Central Peninsula, you might find like chestnuts and gentian root used in the brewing process. So there are a number of themes in Italian craft brewing, which you could call distinctly Italian.
Now, we've eaten in the Jewish quarter, of course, and who hasn't had the artichokes, right?
Yeah.
Which I think are highly overrated. But anyhow.
Did you eat them in the winter or did you eat them out of season? They're served out of season and they're awful.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't like them all burnt.
They might have been out of season. I mean, what the artichoke season in Rome, just when is the Roman artichoke season?
The Roman artichoke season is late December, early January until the very end of April or early May.
Okay.
So we probably hit it.
Because we were there in a market in Rome near the Vatican somewhere where they had the really small, really purple Roman artichokes.
Mm-hmm.
But then,
the Roman ones should be softball sized.
But we were in the little town of Ladispoli or Ladispoli, however the hell you pronounce it.
Ladispoli.
On the weekend of the artichoke festival.
Oh yeah, that was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
We stayed at La Posta Vecchia, and the dinner they cooked for us that night. There were artichokes in every course.
Damn, you're fancy.
And the chefs are wearing artichokes on their head. I think
that's crazy. That's too much.
But I started to say, Zoo, I know about the Jewish ghetto, but I was really shocked to hear about the Cucina Tripolina.
Yeah, there are only 4,000 or so members of the Libyan Jewish community in Rome, so it's a tiny community within a tiny community. And most people don't know about it, and the community is really close-knit and a bit closed off for a variety of reasons from Rome's other 4 million people. And so it's a history and a tradition that not everyone knows about, because most Romans aren't in contact with members of the Jewish community on a regular basis, nor do they tend to be particularly curious.
You know, what is that, the vegetable dish that I love so much? And, it's a chicory.
Puntero.
Oh, yeah.
You only get that in Rome. I mean, you don't have that in your book, do you?
I don't have puntarelli in the book. Catalonian chicory is the English word. Next book.
The what?
Next book. That'd be in the next book.
I tried that. Nobody grows it. They say they grow it. I pick it up at farmer's market, and it's not the same vegetable.
We were lunching outside at a restaurant right opposite Santa Maria de something or other in Trastevere, and the owner of the restaurant showed us how it was done with ice water and everything.
Oh yeah, shave it down to strips. I think people would be surprised to find out how much Roman food is fried.
Oh, yeah, they eat a lot of fried food.
Yeah.
We eat tons of it.
Well, that restaurant in Trastevere, Paris, which is the family name, it doesn't have anything to do with French, that's all they serve, just for deep-fried foods. It's not
fried food is definitely part of the tradition of festive meals. So, and at, fast food spots also, you'll find lots of deep-fried things.
Yeah, but I like also how you point out that even if you have traditional recipes, it varies. The recipe, the dish varies person to person to person. I mean, it used to be I knew about family to family to family, but now it's person to person to person.
It always has been. And the choices that cooks make when they craft their carbonara or cacio e pepe, the techniques that they use and the proportions of ingredients is... Uh-huh. This sort of experience that immediately connects you to the cook. There is no defined cacio e pepe recipe. People are free to interpret it as they wish.
Right, and they do.
That's true. They just never put butter in it in Italy.
Yeah, I had to write an article about the seven fishes one, and that was even more hysterical about how the number of fishes, and what kinds of fishes it varies across the street.
Totally.
Yeah. So, do you think I can make this porchetta di Vito Bernabe here?
Yeah, I mean, you just need to get a pork shoulder. The classic porchetta, the one that Vito Bernabe, the namesake of that recipe, makes, is a belly and loin. But that is not only difficult for the home cook to get his or her hands on, but it's also wildly expensive and feeds 150 people. So, for that particular one, I chose to do a shoulder cut. And then season it the way that Vito Bernabe does, marinating it in the refrigerator overnight so that the salt and pepper and chili and fennel pollen penetrate the flesh and influence its flavors.
Now, you indicated that things were moving in a different direction. Do you think it's going to be, with all this international travel, really highly... modernized to the point of being I think Italy is probably the only country where there's not experimental modernist cuisine.
There's tons of experiments. They're just not particularly interesting.
Well, yeah, Francescana is one, obviously. But
yeah, Francescana is an exception for sure, but I can name a dozen places in Rome that attempt modernist cuisine because they're trying to be interesting without having a real sense of context, without traveling to taste food elsewhere to see how it's executed properly. So I think when it comes to the sort of modernist cuisine, it's there, it's usually terrible, and there isn't a lot of meaningful debate or discussion about what is important and what's sort of a natural feature and what should be consumed.
Well, I mean, there's so much really bad modernist cuisine all over the world.
All over the world, no doubt.
Do you cook at home a lot, or do you, I mean, I guess you do, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, between having to feed myself and developing recipes for the cookbook or articles, I end up doing a lot of cooking.
And you probably don't eat out much, huh?
Oh, I eat out at restaurants every day, at least one meal a day.
Oh, do you? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Gotta stay up to date.
In Rome?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
What's your favorite restaurant, Rome?
Cesare al Casaletto. It's this awesome trattoria in the southern part of the city. It's really, really wonderful and does all sorts of fantastic fried things and classic pastas and offal and meats, and it's just wonderful.
Yeah, we should mention you have a wonderful chapter on offal.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a chapter on offal, too.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
offal.
Here's the deal, Katie. The price for appearing on our program is we need 10 days of recommendations.
No problem.
And you have about 3 months to work on it.
No worries. I got you.
So we'll be in touch again. In the meantime, start making
fabulous notes.
So, Katie, it was really great. I spent a lot of time trying to pin you down to a date. I mean, with your publicist down to a date. So this is a very popular book, and I think it's going to be a very successful one.
Oh, thanks. Hope so.
And best also to Christina.
I'll send along your greetings.
Great. Thanks, Katie, and get some rest.
Never.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, here we are with our final segment, and guess what country we're in for our final segment?
Well, come on, we're still in Italy.
Of course we're still in Italy, yeah, we're in a slightly different part of Italy. But isn't it nice to have a friend who imports wonderful things from Italy, and every time he has something really new and delightful, he says, you got to try this, it's the best, and I'm going to send you some right now.
And this is Rosario Safini, He used to be the go-to guy for truffles. I call him Mr. Truffolo, but he now has this wonderful extra virgin organic olive oil, and I've noted on his business card that he deals only in organic Italian products now. So pay attention. Rosario, how many years do we go back?
I would think it's at least 25 years.
So anyhow, this is Rosario Safina, who has his own company with various things, including a lot of what we've worked with you on is truffle products.
That's correct.
It's the only truffle oil that I've ever used that I like, but I mean, it's like real stuff. It doesn't taste like chemicals, but we'll talk about that later. What we're doing here is, I've known you for so long, when you give a heads up on a product and you're so excited about it, I want you to talk to us about it. And what is the product that we're now going to be talking about?
The product is a Don Rosario 100% organic extra virgin olive oil.
Okay.
There's a little twist to it. It's my partner in Italy, Dr. Sandro Silveri, his father, Giorgio Silveri, has a 19-year-old certified organic olive grove. And Sandro always wanted us to import his father's organic olive oil. That way his father can probably go say to all his friends, I export all my olive oil to the U.S.
Okay.
So of course, I said yes. And then I was like shocked when he told me what the price was.
So it's expensive.
Right, it's expensive.
You see, I didn't think it sounded that expensive. I mean, we've paid more for olive oil.
Yeah, for me, I thought it was expensive when I first heard the price. But then when I tried it, then that made, that was the difference. Then I tasted it and said, well, it's not any of the extra virgin olive oil I bought before. So that was the twist for it. You know, I had the initial shock.
I see.
But then after that, it was, oh, that's why this is so much money.
Well, let's back up a little bit. I mean, olive oil has become an issue. In fact, so has Parmesan cheese. So has all kinds of stuff. It's being produced as extra virgin olive oil, lots of these brands. And in fact, they tested it and found out that that's not the case, that it's been diluted with other things, not even all olive oil. And the Parmesan cheese, of course, has been embedded with wood chips or something. So how does all that happen? I mean, is there an organization that does this? I mean, is there a criminal element involved with this? Or is it just the way business is done?
You know, there was that famous poster in the New York Times, and it was a very good poster. It specifically spelled it out. But to get people to pay attention a little bit more to the poster, they added that little bit of that mafia criminal element, which to me probably, in all relative speaking, doesn't really exist.
Okay.
It is just the way the business is done. Italy is, I always remind people, Italy is a tiny country.
Uh-huh.
It really doesn't produce a lot of anything anymore.
Right.
It's an industrial country. The agricultural space and the amount of people that live there, they produce very little of anything.
Uh-huh. Now they do.
Not just olives. It's a lot of things. They just don't produce a lot of.
Well, now the olives are mainly produced in Spain, no?
Yeah, they do repackage a lot of Spanish olive oil. I guess it comes in comes in by the shipload, and if you read the label on the olive oil you buy from the store, it most likely says packed in Lucca. The implication being, of course, that it's grown in Tuscany near Lucca, but that's not true. It just comes on the boat and gets repackaged. But this olive oil is different. Because
this is all from one single grove in Umbria, just outside of Spoleto.
Yeah, and
only produce 132 gallons. That's what we got from this past season. It'll average anywhere between 100 to 132 gallons.
And you can
nice buttery finish to it. It's not spicy. It's not peppery. It doesn't burn your throat. It's got a very, very, very clean olive flavor, which is a fruit. You know, it's got that clean flavor of, I would always say, fresh olives.
Uh-huh.
Now, you can actually buy this from you, I guess, from Dario Rosario.
Yeah.
In three
liters. On our website and a few select retail stores.
Well, now, hold on just a second. I was going on to say the 3-liter packages, the volume packages, are actually packed in Italy and shipped here, and then
correct.
And then a quantity of it comes in bulk, and then you actually pack that in New York into bottles of the size that fine olive oil is frequently sold in places like Whole Foods and those kinds of places, right?
That's correct. Yep.
So it's a tall, skinny, rather elegant looking bottle.
Yeah, very nice for table service when you're drizzling it on your guests' bread or on their seafood. I even put it on my oatmeal in the morning.
Do you really?
Yeah,
I stopped using butter. I said, I'm going to use this instead. It tastes better.
Yeah, it's sitting on our dining room table right now, in fact. There's always a bottle of the very best quality olive oil that came from somewhere that's on there, and yours has pride of place at the moment.
Oh, well, use it for practice with lunch, breakfast, and dinner. You'll see a lot of usage, a lot of possibilities for it.
Well, you know, I mean, you wanted to get the word out about this quality olive oil, but, I mean, production is so small. I mean, how are you going to balance what's available if you increase the demand for it?
There can't be any increase in supply. I just want to make Sandro's father happy, sell it out in a month or in 2 months, and say good night. You know, he's a little on the senior side. He's not planting any more trees. You know, it's always been the same number of trees. You know, some seasons it may be 180 gallons of oil. But from what he showed me historically, it produces between 110 gallons to about 190 gallons of quality product.
Compare that to like what one would, I don't know what one would compare to, but like a more usual kind of commercial brand, less boutique.
No, you see, when you're talking about Spanish, you see like the Spanish brand out there, Zoe, Z-O-E. And they come in those cute little 500 ml tins, you know, and that's a bulk product from Andalusia in Spain. And it comes from a very, very, very hot climate. All the olives are on the ground, and it takes them weeks to collect all those olives. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening, you know, a lot of those olives just aren't really of good use.
So
you know,
what?
The oil, very spicy, very peppery. Sometimes I always think a lot of that olive oil from southern Spain that hasn't been really handled well comes from, you know, these really huge, huge olive groves, you know, hundreds of kilometers of groves. That stuff is inedible.
Now,
that has to be. That's the type of item that you see a lot of times, and they always talk about denaturing olive oil or
is that what
cleaning
it's called?
Olive oil. It's that's what they do to that type of olive oil. They have to make it edible.
Now it's in, we had an interesting olive oil from Spain one time. We actually found out about it through a company in Seattle that does Italian, that does Spanish wines, not even olive oils, but they did bring in this particular olive oil, and it's from Murcia in Spain. And what they do is they take the olives and they don't grind them in the mill at all. They put them in a pit, and then they put stones on top. They put big stones on top, and then they just the pressure of the stones and the olives on top causes the olives to bleed. And it's
right.
it's called Lacrima.
Yeah.
And it really was seriously good olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with no taint of any kind, and all released just simply with a little bit of gentle pressure, and that was all.
Right. That's what happens with an olive. You know, it's a fruit, so you know, grinding it or squeezing it, it will definitely get its juices out.
So people can go on your website. Why don't you give us that?
Sure. It's www.darosario.com.
Right.
And that's, you know, DAROSARIO.com.
Right. And then if what are there, is there also a specialty store finder there if they want to go to a store? I mean, who handles
it? It's available at Grace's Market. Here in the New York and Long Island. It's also available at Brooklyn Natural.
Uh-huh.
And it's also available at Union Markets.
Okay, very good. So it's Silveri Cesarino Umbrian Extra Virgin Olive Oil.
That is correct.
Great. Of course, everybody's taste in olive oil is different, too. You know, I mean, I happen to like the peppery Sicilian olive oil, but anyhow, back to the other, the bulk of your business though is still truffles, right? It's truffle
yes.
Bar.
You know, I do this olive oil, this organic extra virgin olive oil more or less as a favor, to my partner for his dad. But still 99.9% of our business is, you know, 100% certified organic truffle products.
Uh-huh. Now, I just got a sample of something called truffle zest. What is that?
I do not know what truffle zest is.
it's very finely ground something.
If you want, you can send it to me, and I can send it to a lab. That's another new something, another new scam out there.
It smells a lot like truffle.
It does smell. It smells strongly truffle, but you can also get that.
I always found strange. You know, they would sell truffle powder, and then of course, this is a number of years ago, and two samples went to a lab, and it's just ground up black trumpets.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. Well, they introduced the odor somewhere, whether it's artificial or not, I don't know. But
and it's all that chemical stuff.
But it's an interesting addition to cheer up a dish. What,
right.
was that, what was that egg? You made that dish with eggplant and tomatoes.
I sprinkled
some truffle dust on that.
Zest.
And that was pretty good.
Zest.
Yeah. Well, I call it dust.
I mean, that's a zest. It's like the rind of a lemon or an orange or
something.
There we go. But there's all
yeah,
I had
that,
to.
Oh, I received that zest. Yep.
I had to ask this question.
I tell you what. When we've emptied the bottle, we'll send it to you.
Okay.
When we were in Tasmania and Western Australia, we encountered the Australian truffle growers. Has that cut into your market at all?
No, we actually import fresh black winter truffles from Australia and from Tasmania.
Yeah. They're not bad.
Do you remember who you saw in Tasmania?
The Tasmanian guy, I think, is a crook.
Yeah,
we didn't even run the interview.
We didn't like him.
I thought he was lying.
Oh, so you didn't meet Tom Hall then?
Who?
It wasn't
Tom Hall.
I don't remember.
The best thing about the truffles from the Southern Hemisphere, in particular the ones from Tasmania, the ones from Western Australia, because the soil is very, very hard and very compact, and has a very low mineral content. The truffles are very distorted and disfigured looking.
Oh, really? Because we have a photo.
The truffles from Tasmania, they come from a very, very soft ground, and it's very high in magnesium, and they produce beautiful round truffles.
Tell me the geographical location of what you're talking about in Tasmania.
Okay, so in Western Australia, in and around Perth, in what's called the wine region.
Right, right. We have a picture of a doctor or somebody on our website.
The place in question in Western Australia is called Pemberton. P-E-M-B-E-R-T-O-N.
Yeah.
And they produce the most truffle. They produce almost a little over. That area produces about 1,200 kilos a year.
We trusted him, but the guy in Tasmania, do you remember the area it was in?
It was down in
the southeast area.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Tom Hall, who used to be a chef here in the States, he's originally from Australia. He moved back many, many years ago to get involved in doing the truffle cultivation.
Yeah, well, that's not the guy we talked to. I mean, he was not a chef, this guy.
Oh, and he got some backing and did a number of the groves down there in Tasmania because the soil is very similar to the soil in France in that part of the world, and it does produce a very nice round truffle.
Well,
the flavor from both of them, whether they're from Western Australia or whether they're from Tasmania, have the same, more or less the same terroir and the same flavor, except that, chefs prefer around the truffle because on those very, very knobby, disfigured-looking ones, there's a lot of waste on them.
Yes, there is.
Here was the difference. The ones in Tasmania, the first attempts at production were with a French company.
Mm-hmm.
That really didn't want to let the secret out anyway as to what they were doing, and most of their early implementation was unsuccessful. The guy in Western Australia, Dr. Nick Malgieri, I think, or something like that is his last name, he was actually engaged by an Australian government agency to try to develop truffle production, and I really mm-hmm. don't know why. And he started that out like 25 or 30 years ago, and he was eventually successful and dominates the Southern Hemisphere truffle business, mm-hmm. as you said.
Yeah. And they're also doing them now in Chile.
Yeah, well,
here's
a surprise one for you. A company called the American Truffle Company, which is based in mm-hmm. California, their scientists in England produced the first truffles in England.
Yep.
Recently.
We talked to them about a year ago, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
Mm-hmm.
But Oregon,
I heard it. Yep.
Oregon truffles are like, they don't have any flavor, I don't think, but, well. Well, listen, Rosario.
Some truffles and, well, Tuber Stephen and Tuber Mesotericum grow wild in England, in the UK.
Really? Huh.
Yeah, and at one time, the UK used to be a pretty sizable producer.
Yeah. I don't know. They're also growing champagne grapes.
Have you tried the British champagne?
Yeah, sure.
It's very good.
It's not bad.
Yeah, no, the American Truffle Company guys, they're cultivating.
Yes.
And that's the difference that I told you about, the fact that it was the first the first truffle in England was the first one that was created from a cultivated environment, which of course puts you in a position where you can predictably produce a lot more and have a better supply chain. So they were thrilled about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Rosario, as always, very, very good to talk to you. And keep us posted on what happens next. And, you know, if you have
and
any new products.
And don't forget to try the elbow, because in 2 months when it's gone, it'll be gone.
It'll be gone.
Until the next season.
Well, let's hope you get it sold for your buddy's father before then.
Yes. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rosario.
I appreciate it.
Ciao.
All right.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed your hour in the city of the Seven Hills, and you've learned something new that will encourage you to go there and enjoy yourself if you haven't been there already for the first time, and if you've been there before for the umpteenth time you've been there. As we mentioned earlier, we're heading there for the umpteenth time, so and we're going to have a great time, and we're sure if you go, you will, and you'll find the program here very... You'll find that it brings back lots of memories for you when you're there in person. So, in the meantime, same time, same place next week, what do we say?
Bye-bye.